This is the podcast for Monday, October 24th, 2011, Ethics. So I thought we'd talk a little more about egoism before moving on to utilitarianism. I thought I'd also mention a couple of things about the exam. First of all, you'll all be glad to know that I added 5 points to everyone's exam score. So whatever you saw after you click that submit button, you've got 5 more points. So that's half a grade. So that's a curve just based on the distribution. Those who got the 95% above, you're topping out at 100. Sorry. So and actually the distribution was even before the curve. I think I had 17% A's and 30% B's, and I think I end up with a curve, I end up getting like around 30% A's, so fairly generous curve. Just a couple of the questions that people missed that I would mention. There were several questions that a lot of people missed and shouldn't have. So just and again, if you want to, if you got an A, you can just send me a Moodle message and I'll just tell you which questions you got wrong and which ones you missed. Or you can, anybody can come by my office and we can go over it on my big screen computer. There was a quote, the very first question, only 61% of the people got that quote was about emotivism. And he says, ethics contains no statements, whether true or false. But only statements about the desires of mankind or God, angels, and demons if they exist. But because it contains no statements which are true or false, it's not really scientific. And so the whole thing there is about true and false. And so one thing about emotivism says ethical statements are not true or false. They're just expressions of emotion. Remember in class I was talking about if I just like laughed in class, if I went, ha, 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 I said, okay, was that true or false? You would say, well, wait, you didn't say anything. You just laughed. Or if I say, go Ducks, you know, is that true or false? Well, it's a personal expression of like, I like the Ducks, I want the Ducks to win, right? And so Hume thinks that morality is like this. When you say, oh, wasn't it nice, Bill Gates gave away $1 million to help poor people get on the internet or whatever. You say, yay charity, right? Or if you hear, I think it's some bad thing, that here's the headline from today. Oh, pardon me. A headline from today. Interim Libyan leader plans for Sharia law, more radical than previously thought, as they are expected. I was thinking, well, not more radical than I expected, but, you know, according to Reuters, I guess they're expecting to be a Jeffersonian democracy after they deposed Muammar Gaddafi. But so now when people read that, oh, it looks like Libya is not going to be a Western-style democracy with individual rights, but it's going to be more of the same Islamic theocracy ruled by clerics telling people what to do, they're like, boo theocracy. So when you say theocracy is unjust, or people should have human rights, Hume thinks that this is saying, like, I don't like other people telling me what to do, and I don't like anybody telling anybody else what to do. Why is that? Do I live in Libya? No. Do I know anyone who lives in Libya? No. But Hume says we have this irrational association between our own case and other people. So when you believe in freedom, you don't say, well, I want to be free and everybody else go to hell. We have this human nature that causes us to be sympathetic. And so when you see, people marching around in a foreign country saying, we want freedom, and maybe a few of them got American flags, and they're like down with tyranny, you're like, yeah, down with tyranny. And it's this irrational association, Hume says, that we have of our own desires with the desires of other people. And so then that's just the sympathetic reaction. And Hume thinks that's all there is to morality. So there is no truth of the matter about whether theocracy is better or worse than democracy, or whether a constitutional republic is better than democracy, or whether whether the Wall Street protesters are right or wrong. There's no truth in the matter about whether the Wall Street protesters are right or wrong about the changes they want to make. It's just that, or the Occupy Eugene movement, right? If you have a statement with should or ought in it, it's not about the facts. It's about how people feel, and people feel differently. And so that's the emotivist quote. The language might be a little tough there, but a couple of places in that block quote I gave you, it says ethical statements are neither true nor false. That's a clue that you're talking about emotivism. And that might come up a little bit in the final, because there's a kind of an overview in the last chapter, so make sure you know what emotivism is. Montaigne was not a cultural relativist. I thought I'd beat that into the ground, but apparently not. So even though he's in the chapter on cultural relativism, so is Martin Luther King, right? And he wasn't a cultural relativist either. And so Montaigne was what's known as a soft universalist. A soft universalist thinks that there are absolute moral principles, but they get lived out differently in different societies. So there's the idea of, say, respect. And respect is paid in different ways in different societies. So maybe in Asian society, you meet someone, you bow as a sign of respect. In the States, shake their hand. You show respect to other people, maybe in the United States, by staying out of their business. Maybe in the Eastern countries, maybe it's more like, showing honor and respect due to a person's station or something like that. But the idea is that there's this universal idea that you should respect other people, but what it means to respect other people might differ in different societies. I think of an example. And it gets kind of, one of the problems with soft universalism, it seems like it can kind of snowball into relativism. It seems like you can think of examples like different cultures have different attitudes about things. So I gave the example of this exchange student who wanted to sunbathe topless in a very close quarter raft with mixed sexes. And there are people like, oh no, that's not appropriate. But in Saudi Arabia, a woman walking with exposed forearms and ankles might seem as inappropriate too. So you have different societies have different standards about what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. So the idea is that there's a room for sort of play in these moral absolutes as long as you're not disrespecting people and treating them appropriately. You're doing your moral duty, but what counts as appropriate might vary from culture to culture. So it's not quite relative, and it's kind of absolute, but those absolute principles take different forms in different societies. So it's a way, some people would say it's a way to have your cake and eat it too, right? To be a soft universalist, it sort of straddles the fence between absolutism and cultural relativism. But Montaigne seems to do this. Why? Because he criticizes his own culture. You don't criticize your own culture if you're a cultural relativist. Because you think that if you live in that society and the majority of people believe those things, then that's what you should do. You shouldn't say, well, everybody approves of this and it's terrible. That wouldn't make any sense if you're a cultural relativist. So there was a question on what sorts of things Montaigne thought were great about the cannibal society. And he actually talks about a lot of different things. And this is something I used to items from the audience and sort of make a table with the cannibal culture and the Europeans. I don't think I think I might have done that, but not focused on it. Anyway, the cannibals actually took a trip to Europe, and they're looking at all these poor people laying around who are like starving to death, and then you'd have these people with these big manor houses, and they're like, well, there's more poor people than the rich people. Why don't the poor people just take up why don't they just take up arms and steal, and kill the rich people and steal their food, or at least, take enough to live on. And they were totally confused by this. And then he talks about he actually respects their prowess in battle and bravery and courage. And he also says that he's really amazed at how well they treat their captives, that they don't torture them, they don't mistreat them. he talks about this witty repartee that goes on between the captive and the captor, and like, oh, tomorrow we're going to eat you. You're going to be really delicious. And the other guy says, well, I hope you took it me. And he says, oh, yeah, well, we're going to imbibe the skills of your ancestors. And the guy says, and so I will live on through you. So you just get this sort of, the guy who's a prisoner doesn't really care about dying. He's being brave about it. And the captors, you know, aren't mistreating him as they do in the European countries. All right. There's this other question. Okay, here's a math question for you. 4 out of 10, would that be considered to be nearly half? It's right next to 5 out of 10, right? If you have 10 items and 4 out of 10 meet a certain requirement, I think it's fair to say nearly half of those items meet that requirement, because 4 is nearly 5. So there's a true-false question. Nearly half the Ten Commandments are specific to Judaism and Christianity, their religious laws, and don't really have anything to do with common sense morality. Not working on Saturday is not common sense morality. Not misusing the specific sacred name of God, Yahweh, in the Old Testament is not common sense morality. Not worshiping idols is not common sense morality. Only worshiping Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, and no other gods is not common sense morality. And because you go over to India, right, and there's like 800 million people there who, you know, worship idols, and they worship a whole bunch of different gods, and they might be specially devoted to one god, but they also worship other gods on the side. They don't have a Sabbath day. So it's not, you know, it's not common sense. It's specific to Western culture, Judeo-Christian morality. It's not sort of common sense morality. Now, the other stuff, like don't murder people and don't commit adultery and don't bear false witness against your neighbor. That's kind of common sense. Don't steal, right? Those are common sense morality. But that's 6 out of 10 of commandments. And so it's not as if the entire list is just something that everybody would agree with, because there are lots of people that wouldn't agree with that, with parts of the Ten Commandments. And I think those are the only ones where I had large numbers of people missing. Oh, a lot of people didn't get... 68% got this Plato's answer to Glaucon, why is justice better than injustice? Well, you kind of turn yourself into an irrational beast, and you're living like an animal, going around trying to fulfill your desires instead of being rational and thinking about higher, you know, rational principles. And so Plato wants to identify the moral with the rational and the rational with the moral, and says that when you're being like a thief or a murderer, or when you're breaking these sort of basic rules of morality and only caring about yourself and your appetites, you know, when you're going after money, sex, and power, you're really living, you're lowering yourself to the level of an animal and not being a real human being. So that was Plato's defense. Okay, so 5 points to everybody's score there. Again, if you want to come by and review your exam, sorry you're not able to do that in the lab at this time, but part of the reason I have proctored exams, and there's a whole issue there with passwords, and I don't know why they can't allow you to do the review function without send it out to God and everybody, but there's, for some reason, the system won't do that. So, and I've been after the IT people.
Why
about
were
that.
Note cards taken?
Oh, I think that's so. It's a policy so that some instructors don't want them passing them on to other students. So, for the second exam, I should have told you this with the first one, but for the second exam, write your name on your note card if you want it back. And actually, they're going to give me the note cards back. They're probably sitting in my box today. So if you want yours back, I'll bring them off to class and you can try to identify yours. But for the second exam, if you want it back, if you could just write your name on it, it might help. Or put like a big yellow swatch with a highlighter or some, you know, use a pink note card or something that will help you identify it. Oh, there's a great, I should post that for this class. There was a great, a couple of interesting news stories. One was Vatican decries idolatry of the market. And I'll paste that I'll put that in the forum for this week, actually. They have people comment on that as well. So we were talking about free market capitalism and we've been talking about divine command theory too. So here's an interesting intersection. Most people tend to think about religious people as being kind of conservative about everything. And so the Catholic Church is very conservative about gender roles. It's very liberal about things like capital punishment and about free market capitalism. They don't like it. They want a new global tax on all financial transactions. They're into the redistributing income. I mean, a lot of the Catholic Church's view is, you know, has become sort of Marxist. Particularly in South America, you have this thing called liberation theology that's really big with priests in Central and South America, and it's the idea that God wants you to take from the rich and give to the poor as a form of charity. It's like sort of charity through stealing. But the Vatican has this new report they've issued, where they are talking about the unchecked greed and of the market and how terrible it is. Week 5 already, so we'll get to utilitarianism forthwith. I just want to talk a bit more about egoism and justice because I didn't get a chance to finish this. Let's try this. I just forward through the ones. So here's this is a presentation I gave at the Atlas Society. They're a group which is devoted to the philosophy of Ayn Rand called objectivism. And so here's a kind of overview of objectivism. So I was just, you know, presenting this group, and so the question is, you know, so am I an objectivist? So I just told them, well, it depends on, you know, what your view is. So metaphysics, objective reality, the idea that there's mind-independent reality, and I agree with that, and that the natural and material world is the world known to the senses, and that's the reality, and anything else is, you know, you have to make a good argument for it. Or provide some evidence for it. But that's kind of the starting place, is the evidence of the senses, the natural world, the material world, and that there is an objective material world made of matter. If you want to explore this issue, there's Philosophy 203 next term. And if you're interested in epistemology, there's Philosophy 202, Theories of Knowledge next term. So epistemology is the theory of knowledge. So metaphysics is the theory of reality. So, you know, and these are all Rand's theories of reality. So what's Rand's theory of reality? There is a mind-independent objective reality, the material world out there. It doesn't disappear when you close your eyes. The world continues. And if you get hit by a bus, the world doesn't end. It continues without you. So the world is not dependent on your subjective whims. So there is an objective, mind-independent reality. Naturalism is just the idea that there's just a natural world, that there's no supernatural. So Rand was an atheist, and she was skeptical about any immaterial forces or persons. And materialism, I suppose, is sort of the same thing. It's the only thing that exists is the material world. There's no spiritual world. Epistemology, she said, reason is the only guide to truth. And thought empirical science, you know, is just an extension of reason. So empirical science is just taking rational methods and applying them to study reality, to try to figure out what's true about reality. Now here's the subject of this class, the ethics. So her ethics was a rejection of something called altruism. Now there's kind of a difference between the technical philosophical theory called altruism, first coined by Auguste Comte, the great philosopher Auguste Comte, And what most people mean through altruism. And so, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Altruism is doing for others, doing something for the sake of other people. And so, Rand wasn't against helping people. If you had some sort of reason for it, that it fulfilled your values. So if you feel good about education, and you could start a charity that would educate people. Like the Atlas Society is a nonprofit organization, right? They take donations. And you think about, well, is that hypocritical, right? Because they're, well, donate to Ayn Rand so we can spread the gospel of selfishness. But wait a minute. You want me to give some of my money and give it to you to spread the gospel that I should be selfish with my money? It doesn't make any sense. But Rand would say that your values are broader than that. What self-interest isn't something that's just, you know, me and mine and sort of narrow thing. It's, you know, what you want to do as an individual, your goals and your highest values. So she gives an example of suppose you have like a husband and his wife has terminal illness, and he can either pay for her to have surgery, or you can take the money and go on a vacation in the South Seas, right? So what's the selfish thing to do? And she says, well, to spend the money on her medical treatment is his value. That's if he does that, that's going to be a self-regarding thing, because that just shows that his wife is more important than having a vacation in a sunny place. So it's not as if he's acting altruistically. He cares about his wife. It's in the context of a relationship. And so even though he's doing it for his wife, there's also this sort of element that he's not sacrificing himself. It's not a sacrifice if you're doing something for someone you love. Now, the idea that you have to sacrifice for the whole world, for strangers, and make yourself miserable to make their whole world happy, that's what she's against. And she's also against this idea that you don't have the right to exist on your own. That your only value is your value to society. And unless you can demonstrate your value to society, you're worthless. And she thought that individuals have their own self-worth, and you know, some individuals might be worthless, right? So a person who's a bum, who spends his time bothering people for small change, who can't control his urges, who spends his days drinking and finding ways to get money from productive citizens, I think she would say that person's worthless. And so she's not like some people would say all people have worth, or even she thought was the worst, which is like saying that bum has the same worth as the person who built a skyscraper he's urinating in front of, right? That those two people have equal worth. Or the person who discovered the polio vaccine, or the person who invented the internal combustion engine, or even a person who just has a job and takes care of his family and is a good member of the community. So she would say that all people don't have the same worth, and some people are worth more than others, and some might be worthless, and some might be of great worth. Yeah.
To use consistent lingo, making the differentiation between creators, people who create, and parasites, people who live secondhand off of other people's.
Right. So she would say parasites have low value, but this idea that that you don't have any value yourself unless you do something for others is what she was against. And that you were morally required to sacrifice yourself for the interests of other people. And that your life should be aimed at sacrifice, being a servant of mankind or a servant of God. And she talked about two groups, the mystics of muscle and the mystics of spirit. The mystics of muscle are your godless commies. And your godless commies, they want every productive person to work their fingers to the bone and give all the money to the collective, and it gets divvied up equally, no matter how hard they work. And they're left with whatever the state allows them to have, or whatever the mob allows them to have. And then you have the mystics of spirit who say that you have to, you should feel guilty about enjoying yourself. You have to sacrifice yourself. You know, you have to crucify yourself daily with Christ. You should have to deny yourself, deny your desires, and live a life of asceticism, of simplicity, and again, give away your money to the poor, and tell like you're starving to death or something. And so she thought that both views were misguided, and that both were different kinds of irrational mysticism, and that what the rational person would do would be do something which would further their own ends, and as an incidental result would also further the ends of society. So basically being a productive citizen, doing something of value for other people, and either being self-sufficient or trading with others, which is another form of being self-sufficient. So there's this big sustainability movement here on campus, and so this idea that there's a new sustainability club. And there's this idea we should all be sewing our own clothes and growing our own food. And I, Rand would say that's fine if you want to do that, but that's probably not the most efficient use of your time, because you can go into Wally World and you can get a shirt off the rack and it's going to cost you like $10 or $8.88 or whatever it is, right? Unless it's a fine, you know, T-shirt from T-Furious. Actually, this shirt costs $11. You know, how long would it take me to make my own clothes? And then you have to learn, like, the skills, the time and skills to make your own clothes. I don't even like sewing on a button, so I don't have buttons anymore. It's just, I don't even tell you how to sew on a button. And, like, why would you learn that? Why would you even bother sewing on a button when you can buy another pair of pants for $10? And so Rand would say that this the idea of trade is, particularly in a modern technological society, is very useful. In that, you know, can I make a MacBook Pro? I wouldn't know the first thing about how I know sort of the basics of how computers could work, but I would have no idea how to make a MacBook Pro. So, like, you know, engineers, hundreds or thousands of engineers at Apple, plus a bunch of people working in Chinese factories, have produced this wonder of modern technology, along with all the big skyscrapers and our roads and you know, air travel. You know, I'm going down to San Francisco for the Students for Liberty conference in Berkeley, and you know, it's amazing. It's like I think I waited till the last minute, so I'm paying like, you know, $220 for a round trip ticket to San Francisco. I'm going to get there, and it's a straight shot, so I'm going to get there, you know, 2 or 3 hours either way. It's amazing when you think about the fact that you can do that. You can fly anywhere, and how much it costs. This is something like the pharaohs of Egypt, you know, in their wildest dreams couldn't imagine being able to do with all their wealth and all their money. And it's a result of human progress, the human mind, technology, innovation. And so Rand thinks if you nurture that spirit, the creator spirit, in each one of us, and have us all work together on a peaceful and voluntary basis, it's going to be better for all of us. And so this comes back to what Hobbes was talking about, enlightened self-interest. Now, when you live in a world where everybody's got their nose in everybody else's business, and people aren't thinking, well, how can I improve myself? How can I develop the skills I need to produce wealth or to have a comfortable living? Instead, they're thinking, oh, that so-and-so over there, he's got a lot of money, and I want to have some of that. And then you like spend your life like waving a sign around or camping out at Alton Baker Park about people you think has too much money, and you spend your life in greed and envy and bitterness over the fact that you haven't achieved what others have achieved. Rand would say that's a recipe for disaster. And then when you have the government putting a gun to the heads of productive companies and saying, hey, take some of that money that you produce, that wealth that you produced, and give it to these other people who didn't earn it and didn't produce it, or else, that's going to spell disaster. And a lot of people have said that if you look around at the world today, that's exactly what's happened. And then the politics, capitalism, which, again, what is capitalism? Capitalism is when the means of production are in individual hands. So it's capitalism is the ideals of liberty applied to financial matters. To put it another way, it's freedom. Freedom applied to finance, right? So capitalism just says it's up to you what you buy, what you sell, what you trade, what you invest in, what you produce. And that maybe the state has some role in making sure you're not dumping a bunch of toxic waste into the river where everybody drinks out of. Okay. And maybe you need an army to keep people from taking your stuff and seizing your factory. And maybe you need a police force to keep public order and keep people from stealing the parts of your factory or stealing things out of stores that you're trying to sell so you can take the profit and plow back into R&D and produce more great stuff. And all that stuff is true, but still that's a far cry from what we have today. But capitalism, sometimes called laissez-faire, it's French for like let it be or let it go. Is this idea that you should have, just as you have separation of church and state, and the state shouldn't be involved in religious matters, and religious people shouldn't be using the state to further their ends, so also you should have separation of economy and state. And the state should focus on its protection services, on protecting individuals' right to life, liberty, and property, and otherwise leave people alone, and particularly not try to micromanage the economy. Okay, Altruism, a little comic relief here. So altruism, what is altruism? Well, the blow-up doll, right? The blow-up doll doesn't get anything out of the procreative act, right? It's a passive receptor of other people's... the altruist goes around helping people expecting nothing in return. And so... In a way, it kind of dehumanizes you. It makes you into the tool for other people's pleasure. It doesn't say that you have rights in yourself, that you deserve to be happy, that you deserve to have a good life, that you deserve to follow your goals and dreams and aspiration. No, it says that you have to give back. You have to sacrifice yourself for other people. And this is the idea that, you know, having regard for your own selfish interests is seen as morally suspect. The idea that you're enjoying your life while somebody else is suffering. So there's this idea that you have a selfish duty to further the ends of other people. And this is August Comte's idea of altruism, that your entire moral duty is in furthering the ends of other people. I ask this question, is egoism the proper replacement for altruism? So maybe there's something kind of in between is what I was arguing here. Okay. So we've actually talked about Hobbes. It's a nice picture of him. This picture kind of washed out. Fine picture of Thomas there. So again, Hobbes says morality is a matter of maximizing your own enlightened self-interest. Hobbes is really the first egoist in the history of philosophy, the person that first expounds this idea of enlightened self-interest. And there's a difference between your real self-interest and your apparent self-interest. So can somebody think of an example of where you might be mistaken about what's in your interest?
Buying a new
car. Excellent. So like probably $5,000 at least down the drain as soon as you drive it off a lot. Right? If you just like get a car that's even like a year old, you could save yourself $5,000. And particularly at the age of a lot of the younger students in this class, probably a foolish decision. And if you had to think about the other things you could do with that money and how much the insurance is going to cost. Actually, I had a friend, he was trying to find himself, trying to figure out what he was going to do. He kind of wanted to be a youth minister, but he was also kind of interested in he was like a poli-sci major, and then he was just kind of all over the map. And so he had a place where he needed to get a job, and he started working at McDonald's and found out that he could make like I think at the time he could have made like $30,000 as a manager at a McDonald's, which back in like the 80s was a lot of money. And so he got this job as starting out as assistant manager at a McDonald's. And he's thinking, I'm going to be a McDonald's man. And after I'm assistant manager, then I'm going to be manager. After I'm a manager, I'm going to be a district manager. And I'm going to go to McDonald's University, and they're going to teach me how to be a district manager, and I'm going to be a company man. It's going to be great. And I don't have to fool with school anymore. I don't have to live on the pittance of a youth minister. It's going to be great. Well, after about 3 months of working there, he decided he hated working at McDonald's. In the interim, with his new salary, he bought a brand new Mustang and still had the payments to keep up. And so he was sort of in a pickle in that quitting this job at McDonald's would mean that he was going to have a tough time paying off his car. And so that's, you know, good example of real versus apparent self-interest. Some people might suggest like cigarette smoking. Okay, I'm gonna move on and not give the joke examples I'm thinking of involving electoral politics. So is there a difference between morality and prudence? Well, in egoism, there isn't. What's prudence? Prudence is doing what's in your own interest. The prudent thing is the thing which, like, you think, okay, should I study for my ethics test or should I go out and get drunk with my friends, right? And the prudent thing is to study for your ethics test, because when you come in, like, on the last day to take the test and you're, like, you know, got a terrible hangover and you fail the test, then that, the consequences for that are probably going to be a lot worse than missing out on a night of drunken revelry. We talked about Gaiji's ring. That's where we came in. Okay, so Rand believes in this concept of natural rights. And she thinks that rights stem from man's nature as a living being. So where do rights come from? So the founding fathers talk about rights coming from our Creator. You know, we have certain inalienable rights, rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, we're endowed by our Creator. Well, Rand didn't believe in a creator. So where does she think rights come from? Well, she says rights come from human nature. They're natural rights. And that the concept of virtue means that you respect certain things, and you respect them in a general sense. So it means respecting life, and that just means that there's a right to life. That respecting reason and freedom. And to respect them generally as values, not just your own life and your own reason and your own freedom. And again, it comes back down to this, you know, can you really say, well, it's good for me to be rational, but it's bad for other people? It's kind of hard to think that way, right? If you want to say reason is good, you don't want to say reason is good for me, but reason is good generally. And actually, I mean, it's in your interest to not just be rational yourself, but for other people to be rational. I don't know, you're taking a walk out in the forest or something, and you lose your way, right? And you're with a friend, and you're thinking, oh man, I don't know much about the woods, and that was probably a bad idea to come out here. And you know, who would you want your friend to be? So imagine, like, your friend, you know, all of a sudden starts, like, crying uncontrollably, or they fall down on their knees and say, Jesus, please save me, please save me, right? And it's just going to hysterics, or they tell you, you know, I'm going to be one with the Tao, and they're kind of, like, doing this weird thing and kind of, like, trying to become one with the Tao and find which way is the way out of the forest, right? You don't want to be around an irrational person like that. You want to be around a person who would say, well, you know, I see. I remember we came from the West, and if you look at the moss and trees here, the moss grows on this side, and so therefore we need to go that way. And you know what you could do if you, like, we can, like, here's how you make a compass, right? And they get like a paper clip and the magnetic clip on their power book, and they use it to magnetize the paper clip in their bag and then put it in a little dish of water, and it spins, tells you which way north is or something, right? You want a rational person. You want a person who's a problem solver. You want a person who can figure things out. You want a person who can control their emotions. And those are the kind of things that have survival value. So for her, it all comes back to survival value. So it virtue means wanting there to be a rational world, and so you cultivate reason in yourself, and you want to cultivate reason in other people. You want to live yourself, and you don't want other people around you to die, right? Because they could, each person has potential value for you. And the same thing with freedom. It's not as if you want to be free, but you want everyone else to be a slave. You need to respect freedom generally, because freedom, denying freedom to your neighbor is probably in the long run going to mean somebody denying freedom against you. So what you want to do is have an agreement with lots and lots of people that it's better to be free than unfree, and have a sort of mutual agreement that freedom is a good thing. And that's kind of what we have here in this country, in our political system, more or less. Except for, you know, you can see this especially in contrast with, say, a society under Sharia law where clerics can tell you how to live your life, or an autocratic government like the former Egypt or Libya, which is sort of the same thing except for it's a military junta, or in China, which, you know, has radically restricted rights.
Question?
Yeah.
Would Rand concede, or what would she say, that in her closed system, that hers is any better than anybody else's?
Yes.
Would she concede that it is her opinion that this is better?
No.
She would
concede it's her opinion, but her opinion is correct.
What's her empirical evidence that her system is nothing more than she just thinks the right people need to be in charge?
Well, she wouldn't agree that the right people need to be in charge. She would say that the right principles need to be employed. It's not a matter of people, though. It's a matter of ideas and principles and objective principles of reason consistently applied.
Okay, so her natural rights, where do they come from?
Human nature. They're those rights which allow human beings to survive and flourish and be happy.
Okay. And why is that any better than despotism?
Because in despotism, life is chaotic, people are poor, despotic societies produce less, and there's less innovation, and the happiness of each person is less. Simple as despot.
Okay, so I guess her point is that, and the reason why I'm asking this is because she is, you know, when she calls everybody who doesn't come up with snuff parasites, it's almost the same attitude as what I've heard in the past of useless healers. It's the same sort of attitude. Why is her standard for what's right and good any better than the Sunnis?
Well, she would say the useless eater idea, that's an altruistic concept that assumes that you need to be useful to society. What she would say is that if you're self-sufficient, you don't have to provide any reason to justify your existence. You exist in your own right as an individual. Now, the parasite is taking from others, either through force or through guilt. And so that's her sort of definition of the parasite, or through the parasite is both like the politician who survives on robbing Peter to pay Paul, or it's on Paul who's getting the largesse.
Okay, I guess what I'm asking, let me ask the question simply: what would be her most powerful statement that she could make why her philosophy is correct over all others? Is it her idea or theory of natural rights? Is her theory something What is her most powerful, unassailable argument that she is right and everybody else who disagrees with her is wrong?
I mean, I think you get it in the excerpt from Atlas Shrugged, and they're hard to reduce to a single sentence. But I think she would say A equals A. I mean, she starts out with that, right? A equals A. That existence exists. There is an objective world. The way to know that world is through reason. When you apply reason to the sphere of values, you see that you as an individual want to exist and want to be happy. And then you come up with those virtues which will fulfill those rational goals for the sort of being you are, a living being. And those are the virtues of productiveness, the virtues of you know, rationality and objectivity. And the virtues of cooperation with your fellow man, and to trade on a voluntary basis and try, instead of trying to order other people about. And she says, if you look through the despotism is an irrational, the irrational idea that you need a leader to tell you what to do, and that society is better off, or each individual is better off with a person that has all the power and controls people. I mean, that's sort of in a nutshell what she would say. That force and fraud are never used systematically, or even in an individual case, are never really in your long-term, overall, actual self-interest, your light self-interest. And we'll actually get to that near the end here. So, but this kind of hits on this question about, is she, when she's saying that you know, values are objective, is she sort of violating what Hume says, which is you can't derive an ought from an is. You can't stake a statement about what is the case, and then make an argument for what should be the case. And again, Hume thinks that all ought statements are non-factual. And so I think that what you might say, though, is that values are really, they're a pragmatic guide to happiness. Values are those things, and Rand actually says that values are those qualities of character which will help you fulfill your self-interested desires. Some criticisms of Rand, I mean, one might be like Nietzsche. So Nietzsche says, if you look at the world, the world is exploitation. Life itself is exploitation. Living things exploit other things in the environment. The oak tree grows up and puts its branches up to the sky, and it sends its roots down as deeply as possible and tries to suck up all the moisture. As a consequence, all the grass around the oak tree dies out. Does the oak tree mourn the grass? Does it try not to suck up too much water so that it can share with the grass? No, it just sucks up as much water as it can to make itself as big as it can. And you look at nature, you know, nature is survival of the fittest. It's a red in tooth and claw, as some poet said.
Well, Rand kind of goes on that survival of the fittest, because she says, when I'm given claws, we're given intelligence.
Right. I think Nietzsche would say, though, and this is one of the places where Nietzsche departs, you know, is different from Rand. Rand actually was sort of enamored of Nietzsche, and if you look at her earliest work, it's a little more dark and a little more kind of, I don't know what you call it. You can tell she's under the spell of Nietzsche. And later on, you get more sort of John Locke and this more positive, uplifting view. I think a less antisocial view. And this might have to do with, you know, her coming out of Russia and a lot of things in her personal biography. But if you look at her early work, that there's a play she wrote that was made into a movie when she was really young, and it's got that sort of aspect. Yeah.
Did Rand talk about the problem of if you have free capitalism, then the people with the most money are controlling art and things like that, that really shouldn't necessarily be in the hands of, like, if art is controlled by the people who have the most money, then obviously the art that depicts, you know, the struggles of poor people or, you know, injustices like that, that would be against their interests, aren't going to succeed.
Yeah, I think she would say that this idea that having a lot of money gives you power is a false notion, because the only way that a corporation can have power over you is if they're in bed with the government. And what so a corporation
can. Not in her ideal world, right?
No, I'm talking about the real world.
Right, I'm talking about, like, if we all lived in an objectivist world, what's her answer to problems like that arise?
Well, I think she would probably deny that it's a problem. She would say that this idea that having money gives you control is a false notion. It's the government that controls. If you have money, you can use the government to control people indirectly. But it's really the government doing the controlling. So if you have a limited government, you know, like, for example, my brother worked for the California Arts Council. They produce all kinds of, they fund all this work. So they take money from the taxpayers of California and they fund projects they deem worthy. I think Rand would say that if you want to create art, you can either create yourself with your own money, your own funds, or you can do what, you know, Da Vinci and all those Dutch masters used to do, which is find a patron. One of those two things. Or you can find a corporation that wants to fund you. And there's actually are corporations that fund art projects. And even some liberal ones. Actually, you have lots of corporations that fund all manner of liberal causes, too. The Ford Foundation. I mean, you'd be hard put to find, I mean, apart from the Koch brothers, I don't know of any, like, major giant corporation that actually funds, you know, right-wing causes. And typically, you get, GE is all about green energy. They're all about the interests of GE, and then that sort of they're in bed with the Obama administration because they're the guys that happen to be in power. Citibank gave more money to Obama. Why? Because, you know, he's going to be in there. And then Goldman Sachs, right? You got people, you know, Ben Bernanke and Tim Geithner, who are, you know, working as the Federal Reserve Chairman and the Treasury Secretary. They're both like these Wall Street guys, investment bankers. So I think in the existing system, you do have that sort of, it's the money people and the government people colluding together. Rand wanted those separated. So she would say, if you have separation of economy and state, corporations have no power over you except for to kill you with low prices, to torture you with wide selection, and to tantalize you with great products. And if you think about art, you know, do you have the right to have somebody else pay for your art? I mean, and particularly today, I think Jeff Goolsbee talks a lot about this. He's the new head of Media Arts, about how it's so cheap right now to produce your own art digitally and to get wide distribution on the internet. And the means of production for music artists, for visual artists, is all coming to the hands of the individual now with the technological revolution of computing and the internet. And Rand fancied herself an artist, too. She wrote a book called The Romantic Manifesto, which gives her theory of aesthetics and the philosophy of art. And she thought art was very important. She just thought, I mean, what do you get? She might also say, what do you get when the government funds art? You get, you know, really ugly metal sculptures in front of government buildings that nobody likes to look at. You get some guy who's gets an NEA grant for, like, sending blood-soaked shirts over the audience, dripping blood, and telling them that the blood is infected with AIDS, and watching them head for the exits. They fund pictures of a crucifix in a jar of urine. A porn star, Annie Sprinkle, showing audience members her cervix in her public cervix announcement, and then dousing herself with chocolate. Right. All at taxpayers' expense. So, I mean, that's the what you get, I think, when you get government funding of art. Basically, you have people doling out money that probably nobody's going to pay for. Right? If you make good art, people are going to pay for it. If you're kind of this fringy person who does stuff that doesn't have mass appeal, well, then nobody's going to pay for your art, or maybe a few people will, or maybe a couple of nut jobs. But do you deserve to live high on the hog at taxpayer expense? Rand would say no. If your desire is to create great art, then you should do that. You're free to do that. You're just not free to take somebody else's money to in order to do that. So if holding truth, human life, and liberty and happiness as values create prohibitions against force and fraud, which we were just talking about, why don't they also create altruistic moral requirements to advance these values for others? So this is kind of a tough objection. So this is the Good Samaritan. Picture the Good Samaritan helping some guy who's been beaten up by thieves in the road. And what the Good Samaritan does in this parable told by Jesus is he takes this person who's a Samaritan, who's a sort of hated religious minority, religious and ethnic minority, and hated by the Jews. And so he takes this person who's been beat up by robbers, takes him to the inn, pays a doctor, pays the innkeeper, and takes care of him. Without expecting anything in return. And so if you're prohibited from using force and fraud, are you also, if you say life is not just, it's not just my life, but life generally is my value, does that just mean you can't take the lives of others? Or does it also imply that you have to further the lives of others? Like, not just not kill people, but maybe to save people. Not just don't infringe on the liberties of others, but to actually free people. Not just think about your own happiness, but actually work for the happiness of others. I think that might end up pushing utilitarianism off till Wednesday, but that's okay because we've got like 2 weeks for utilitarianism, so I built in a little wiggle room there. So this might be the objection in that later on when we talk about Kant, we'll talk about positive duties and negative duties. So a positive duty is like a duty to help people. A negative duty is a duty not to do a certain thing, not to steal, not to lie, not to kill. Positive duties is a duty to help people in need, to develop your talents, to actually do something positive to bring about value, as opposed to not doing something negative that brings about disvalue. So, the question you might ask of the ego is, okay, so the ego says to value life, liberty, and happiness doesn't mean you just value it in your own case, but to have those as values means to believe in them as sort of abstract ideals that are not just good for you, but good for everyone. But then, and so therefore, it's wrong for you to use force and fraud against other people, not because of some sort of disembodied moral principle, but because that's your value. And it's a good value for you to have. And so when you take someone's life, you're violating that value of life that you yourself hold. So you're violating your own value. But then the thing is, if you don't, say, send $30 to save the children this month, there's a child that's going to die. Well, isn't that example of not valuing life too? So this sort of, it seems like altruism rears its ugly head. And we'll get to this in utilitarianism too. There's a section Peter Singer talked about world poverty and talked about the fact that spending money on your projects and the things that you enjoy is money that's not going to save people who are starving to death today, particularly children under the age of 5 who will die without your help. So then what's your moral duty? You go out to that concert, you buy that pizza, you renew your cable subscription, or download that music on iTunes, or do you send that money to somebody you don't even know? So obligations to render aid and promote the general welfare, or even sacrifice for it, seems like it serves man's survival, right? So this kind of altruistic impulse, you might think, actually might serve a useful social function, right? Sort of helping other people. So you might say this idea of thinking, well, I just think about littering, right? So to like keep your litter in your car is sort of a pain, and it's easier just to throw out the window, right? And then you look at all the trash and you're thinking, well, I'm never going to come by here again. Maybe you're passing through some small hick town, you're just driving through and you're like, eh, you just throw your trash out the window, right? This is a McDonald's bag with all the wrappers. You're like, I'm never going to see that. But you know, if you get a bunch of different people doing that, then pretty soon there's trash everywhere. And so the fact that you know, there's a sort of consciousness about litter, and people, at least sometimes in certain situations, they feel guilty about just throwing their trash in the ground, you know, leads to, you know, there not being junk everywhere, at least in certain areas. So if you have, it's a little stronger in some areas, like Singapore. I think Singapore, you get a big punishment if you litter. But my friends tell me Singapore is beautiful and there's no trash anywhere. And it's because people have respect for their environment around them. And it's not just like personal, because personally it might be that, oh, well, it's easier for me to throw this trash down. But if you think about, yeah, but what does that do for other people? And you say, okay, well, I'll just take it with me and throw it in a can when I get a chance. And so it seems like that society is better off that people sort of, you know, hang together and try to promote the general welfare and aren't narrowly focused on their own self-interest. And here's this comic. Lucy's intrigued by the idea that we have a purpose, that there's a purpose of life. And she says, you say we're here on Earth to make others happy. And he says, that's right. And then she says, well, what are the others put here for? Right? So this kind of paradox I talked about earlier, that this idea that nobody has any inherent worth, but somehow there is a good thing that we help other worthless people, and in helping other worthless people, somehow that gives us worth that we didn't have before. So it's this weird paradox that the altruist has. So what's generally good for humanity isn't always good for me in every particular case. So Rand keeps on talking about what man requires for the furtherance of his life. But then what about what this man requires, right? And those might be different things. Maybe, can somebody think of an example where maybe what you require might be different than what society requires? Or what's in the general public interest versus what's in your narrow self-interest? Okay, go ahead.
We can look at different communities, certain communities that are voting on things and it has a lot of younger families and they vote for a lot less Medicare and you know, Social Security benefits and things like that. Or let's say a retirement community or an area that has a lot of retired people will not vote for funding for schools because, you know, it doesn't affect them.
If you think that Medicare and Social Security are great programs and don't think that they're going bankrupt, I suppose that'd be a good example. The same thing about like, you know, government schools, I guess. But if you think education is good, suppose you think it's good that children be educated, but you don't have any children, I guess the idea is that you might not vote for a school bond or something like that. Sure, or you get this NIMBY thing, not in my backyard. And so you get, like, say, they want to put in a homeless shelter. And what happens is that people who live near where the homeless shelter is going to be, they're like, oh, the homeless people are going to be converging on my neighborhood. You're not going to put it next to my neighborhood. My kid's going to walk that way to school. Or they want to put in a power plant. People, I don't want to live next to a power plant. Or you have this case where they want to put some... there was a plan to put these wind turbines off of Cape Cod, and the Kennedy clan said that this would spoil their view of the horizon and you know, Nantucket Isle. And so you get like Robert Kennedy Jr., who's a sort of a green energy guru guy, and the rest of the Kennedys trying to stop this wind turbine project, which is green energy. And green energy is actually a good example. So you get GE. GE wants what's good for GE. And what does GE want? Massive government subsidies for green energy, even though it's more expensive, even though it's inefficient. And so GE wants lots of government money. Now, that money is going to come from taxpayers, right? Do they care about the overburdened taxpayers? They're going to have to pay more so GE can have its new green energy projects? No, because it's going to make the shareholders happy. GE wants laws against incandescent light bulbs. Why? Because they're the ones selling the curly light bulbs, because they can charge a lot more for those curly light bulbs. And so you get this idea of narrow self-interest or special interest versus the sort of general welfare of society. And you get people like with children too, that, you know, they want those child tax credits, by God, because I got kids and I want to get a tax break because I chose to have kids. And it's a form of subsidy. Let's see. So there's this question about you having like principles. Is that really an egoist thing to do? Shouldn't you take things on a case-by-case basis? An example of, like, if you find a lost wallet. Okay, well, maybe it's in my interest to have thieves punished, generally speaking, but it might be in my interest to take the money out of this wallet and then return it to see if I can get a reward on top of it, right? Because I don't want to take the risk to, like, try to use the credit card. So there's cameras on top of the ATMs, you know, it's kind of risky. But nobody's going to know if I take the money out, right? I'll say, oh, I found this in a dumpster. Right? Maybe I find it laying on the ground, and I tell the person, oh yeah, I found this in the dumpster, and the money was gone, but it still got your credit cards and your driver's license, save you some trouble. And they're like, oh, thank you very much, and maybe they give me a crisp 20 on top of the 100 I got out of the wallet. Well, why, as an egoist, why shouldn't I do that? So that might be an objection against Duran, this idea that abstract general principles are going to serve your long-term self-interest. Now, she has some things to say about that, which we'll get to in a second. There's also another objection, is that egoism seems like it's kind of like a version of utilitarianism. So it's a teleological theory. What is a teleological theory? It's a theory which says that what counts is the goal, not the means to attain the goal. So what's the goal? Self-interest. So what's the means to attain it? Well, whatever attains the goal, whatever means necessary. So there's some flawed criticisms of utilitarianism. And one is that this idea that since your action will always depend on the particulars of the case, that it's a form of moral relativism. And that's not really true. Egoism is an objective theory. It's not a form of relativism. And it does seem to depend on the particular case. So it's I think you can't say, well, egoism is kind of a subjective theory, because what's in your interest is an objective thing based on what your desires are, whatever they happen to be. Based on whatever your goals are, there are better means to attain it and there are worse means to attain it. There are efficient means to attain it and there are inefficient means to attain it. So it's not a form of moral relativism. And then there's also an objection that it's too difficult to try to figure out what's in my interest. And I think that there you can just generally follow maybe some rules of thumb, right? You could say, well, I don't have to figure out in every case, like, for every moment of my life, I don't have to figure out what's going to give me the best consequences. I can kind of figure out what works and over time kind of go on autopilot. Use a rule of thumb. Like, generally, if my neighbor is, say, playing a stereo too that loud, I don't think, okay, well, I could, like, murder him in his sleep, or I could burn his house down, or I could go over and ask him nicely to turn it down. And then, you know, if that doesn't work, maybe call the police and file a complaint or something, right? So I don't have to, like, each time consider all possible options. I have to have, you know, generally speaking, you know, it's a bad idea to murder people or burn their houses down, because, you know, could be some bad consequences along the line. I don't have to calculate, okay, what if I'm really sneaky and nobody knows we have this dispute about the stereo, or what if I sneak in the middle of the night and maybe I could cut his throat without waking up his wife? Or, you don't have to calculate each of those possible consequences. Generally speaking, murder is not going to be my interest, so I don't have to consider that. So you could kind of go on common sense moral rules in ordinary circumstances. So there's this idea you could follow as an egoist. You could just follow rules of thumb of common sense morality most of the time. And then when you come up with an unusual situation, then maybe you could kind of just follow what seems to pay off the most. So although you might be generally honest, if you find a wallet with a bunch of money in it, say maybe $5,000, you're like, well, this is a lot of money, and I think I'm going to keep this, right? And it's maybe worth the risk because there's nobody around, so the risk is zero. So here, this idea of exception. So generally speaking, this guy doesn't pick up hitchhikers, right? But there's a hot chick on the side of the road, and he tells his angry-looking wife that he thinks this time they should make an exception. So this idea of a rule of thumb, though, it's not an absolute rule. It's a pragmatic guide to getting what you want. And so when the rule doesn't serve your purpose, you're free to break it. Okay. Move on here. When the rule doesn't serve its purpose, you're free to break it. And this PowerPoint's up on Moodle as well. I got posted in the egoist section. I just didn't hit all these slides. So here's an objection. Let's see what we got here. I'm going to skip over a couple of these things so we can get through this. So a hypocrite. So this idea that one of the arguments that Rand has against this sort of idea that you can say one thing and do another, that you can kind of be like Glaucon, putting on a good face and then slinking around in the shadows and stabbing people in the back. And she says that hypocrisy creates this false consciousness, and nobody can really live like that. But the idea is it only creates a false consciousness if you're thinking, I have this absolute value and I'm going to violate it. If you don't think about values as being absolutes, but you think about them as being, again, these practical guidelines which serve you most of the time but aren't absolutes, then you're not going to have guilt and you're not going to have these problems. I'm going to kind of skip to the end here, and I'll post this on Moodle here. There's just hit a couple of things as an overview. So how can you square egoism with justice? So what's in your interest? It's in your interest, your enlightened self-interest, to promote a system of government which protects your rights and to obey the law when necessary. And I would say this is going to be most of the time. So whether you should obey the law and how good the state is at catching and punishing people, is going to depend on the case. But you'd want, let's see how I was blinking there at you, you'd want a system which robustly protects your rights, even though it's going to limit your chances of stealing. Also, you have natural human sympathy, which is built into your being as a human being, built into your nature as a human being. And so, because of this, even though it might be irrational, you're stuck with it as a human being. And these natural feelings kind of make life worthwhile. They're part of what makes you happy. The joy you get in, playing with a cute little kitten, for example, right? It has to do with this sympathy and benevolence. Evolutionary psychology. Morality comes from our evolution as social creatures, and maybe that's okay. Maybe, again, that's just built into human nature. And instead of trying to fight against it, maybe what's going to make your life most worthwhile is to say, hey, I'm a social creature. I like being around people. I like helping people. I like cooperating with people. I don't like conflict. I don't like fighting. I don't like war. I like free and voluntary cooperation with people of like mind, and to be able to pass people on the street without having to worry about, you know, what they're going to do. And so social and legal structures generally that we have here generally reward good behavior. So in modern American society, it's in your interest most of the time to obey the law, at least particularly in the big things. Otherwise, you're going to end up in jail, criminal record, it's going to be hard to get a job, and so on and so forth. And the thing is, even those small little things, you know, can come back to bite you, right, in the hindquarters. So here's, you know, a person that ended up with like a humiliating punishment of having to stand in front of Walmart, advertising the fact that they took something that just cost them some pocket change, maybe, right? So even petty crime can have serious consequences. So that's when you have a really high, you know, even though the risk factor might be low, if there's a really high possibility of a really big negative, if the risk is low, if the penalty is high, that's a reason not to do something. So a large consequence can make even a small risk not worthwhile. You never know when somebody is going to be really, really upset about that little thing you did to them and come back to get you later on. So I think that's what this is about. So you have to think about, you know, human beings can be vindictive, and so it's best to be at peace with all men. And what's the way to get ahead in life, being a petty criminal? No, it's winning friends and influence people, a la Dale Carnegie. All right, so we're going to start up right at the beginning of class, next class, with utilitarianism.